Hey, welcome to Info Under the Radar, the show where we talk with an expert to simplify everyday ideas, concepts, and subjects that surround us.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Info Under the Radar. I'm your host, Vishwajit.
And I'm Devendra. Today, we are here to talk about a topic, or rather a technology, that you might have heard in some capacity here or there, either in news or somewhere in blogs or on social media. It's deepfakes. Before we proceed anything, I am a student of deep learning, so I have heard about it enough during my studies and out of my personal interest. But Vishwajit, do you remember when was the first time or the time that you actually remember where you got introduced with deepfakes and you got to know about the term for the first time?
I think it was a couple of years ago when all these kind of funny videos on social media started appearing of celebrities. Deepfakes of celebrities. And then later politicians, I think the famous one was from, one of them was from Obama as well, which got very viral. I guess that's how I got to know about the technology.
And now it has taken its more rather what could be called like a serious shape, where it's very hard to detect even for humans if you see them. Like you would have seen the video from President Zelensky that got popular during the war times, which is kind of scary. So that is the technology that we're going to talk about. We hope that some of you would have heard about it. Even if not, we have tried our best to cover all the grounds that are possible. This was also a rather special episode in another sense, that this was the first time, I assume, we had two experts on the panel at the same time. And these are not just any two experts. Apart from being really good and credible researchers, they were actually the people who coined the term deepfake in the research community for the first time with their seminal paper in 2017, if I remember correctly the year. Their names are Professor Sebastian Marcel and Dr. Pavel Korshunov.
And these two are, as you said, that they are the guys who coined the term. They are both also accomplished researchers. So Sebastian is a senior researcher at IDIAP lab, which is a very famous lab in Switzerland for the research in artificial intelligence. He's also a lecturer at EPFL, and he's heading a research team and conducting research on face recognition, speech recognition, vein recognition, and anti-spoofing. And Dr. Pavel is a postdoctoral researcher also at IDIAP lab and EPFL, where he is looking into deepfake detection, speech diarization, and tempering detection in video, among other things.
And their lab is also a special position because they research on deepfake detection, not just from an algorithmic standpoint, but also using people as part of their research, that, okay, how good are humans on detecting a particular deepfake? So that was an interesting area and ground to cover up while we were having the conversation with them. During the course of the conversation, of course, we talked about a lot of stuff. What is deepfake is something intuitively known by many people, I assume, by this point. We also talked about what is not a deepfake. Then how easy it is for a person who doesn't belong to deep learning or even computer science community to create a deepfake these days. And then why is creating a deepfake so easy, but at the same time, detecting what is a deep fake or what is a fake video versus what is a real video is a challenging problem. And we talked about the fact that, okay, it all boils down to the idea of semantics, which is a popularly known term or a popular problem when it comes to the field of computer science per se. To be able to identify semantics is always challenging. So we discussed in length about what exactly is that and what makes it so challenging for humans and for machines. Does it even have any use cases outside of all these fun activities? Does it even have any use cases? Researchers always point out to the fact that, okay, deepfakes we'll be using for creating artificial data on which we can train safely. We can create artificial faces so that facial recognition is better. But does it even have any use case outside of either like this entertainment community or deep learning community? So we talked about that. And of course, when you talk about such a controversial term, once we have clarified the basics, the use cases, and the issues with it, ethics is something that is always to be touched upon, because it's not something that we can leave these days.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we also talked about how social media companies are trying to fight with deepfakes, because as you can imagine, on social media platforms, it's a big problem, especially going forward, where, for example, especially when it comes to elections or any things where facts matters a lot. As they've said earlier, it's getting harder and harder to detect deepfakes. So we also looked into briefly with Pavel and Sebastian what these social companies are doing to fight with deepfakes. And also, lastly, we also touched upon the future of technology and what excites the researchers in the near future about this technology.
Right. So with all that ahead, without further ado, let's head to our conversation with Professor Sebastian Marcel and Dr. Pavel Korshunov. Thank you for taking out time for us, Sebastian and Pavel, on this early morning. How are you doing?
It's going very well. Thank you. Thank you very much.
It's good so far. So the topic that we're talking today is about deepfakes. Now, this term has, everyone has a different perception of it, fortunately or unfortunately. You guys coming from the research domain, of course, know it in much more academic detail. I, being an enthusiast and doing my master's, know somewhat basics of it. And Vishwajit, coming from computer science, has already have some idea from reading on the news and stuff. So there's a lot of misnomer going around when I talked with my friends around that what deepfake is. So the way when I describe it to anyone who doesn't know it, I say that, okay, it's some sort of a synthetic media of maybe a person who exists but never said that thing in a video format or audio format or a picture, or someone else said it and there was a face masking them. So that's basically deep learning community's response to Photoshop. This is how I normally put it in a slightly colloquial way. But that's not the entirety of it, right? So how do you guys identify or define in your terms what deepfake is? And more importantly, what is not a deepfake?
Right. So I may start then, just to give a bit of context. So deepfake is now becoming a general term for you talked about synthetic media and manipulations. I'm just going to put a bit of context on that. It's also a kind of a buzzword, a bit like artificial intelligence, I would say, nowadays. Mm-hmm. So, but actually, this is a pretty recent term that popped up maybe in 2017, I would say, around 2017. So, and to understand that term, you need to understand that this term is made of two words, deep and fake. So fake come from this art, or from people that were doing faking of images, mostly. So doing digital manipulations, mostly swapping faces of celebrities, this kind of thing, with images on the internet. And it exists since internet almost exists, right? So faking images. So this is where it comes from. And then it turns out that just before 2017, there have been a number of technologies in what we call artificial intelligence nowadays, but actually, which is mostly what we call in reality deep learning technologies, machine learning technologies, which has been used for more and more for many tasks and solving mostly image classification or image recognition problems with those deep learning architectures. And around at that time, there was a specific model in deep learning that was invented and proposed to generate synthetic images, which were the GANs, the so-called GANs, the generative adversarial networks, or as well as autoencoders, which are specific deep neural networks, which have also the capabilities to generate images, to synthesize images. And at that time, the people that were doing fakes by hand, right, had the idea to use these models or these techniques that have been popularized in deep machine learning, deep learning, to synthesize images and to automatize the process. So basically to synthesize better, maybe faster, the image of someone and to insert it in the face of someone else in the media, right? Mm-hmm. And this is all started like this in 2017, I think, with a celebrity that was for which the face was deepfake, and then they put the face of someone on the body of someone else, let's put it that way. And then became more and more popular, and this term therefore became popular, and that we're talking about deepfake. But actually, from our perspective in academia, in research, so deepfake is a specific attack vector to do image manipulations, and in particular, digital manipulations. Mm-hmm. So digital manipulations are in majority done on images, so static objects like images. It can be face swaps. It can be other form of alterations, not necessarily face swaps, but modifying the face or adding artifacts or other things. When you do digital manipulations, the specific technique that you use to do this manipulation is not precise. I mean, the deepfake technologies is one of those, but there are others that exist. It can be more mm-hmm. traditional, I would say. Then you have digital image manipulations. You can also manipulate digitally videos. This is also why deepfakes are very useful, because since it is automatized or semi-automatic, I would say, it's much easier to manipulate with a deepfake a video rather than by hand, right? And then we have seen also the possibility to manipulate audio signal, audio recordings, voice of people, and by extension, audio visual recordings. So people, talking faces, basically. Mm-hmm. So right. So this gives a bit mm-hmm. bit of context. I don't know if Pavel wants to add mm-hmm. on that.
Yeah. So yeah, I agree with this. I would only probably add that this deepfake also coincides. This appearance of deepfakes coincides with the darker side of internet, as Sebastian mentioned, that it's manipulations exist as internet is, but also it was from the kind of pornographic community that it actually came to right. pass. Yes, and that's also the reason why it kind of made an impact socially wise, because it appears very quickly that it's a dangerous and like disruptive technology that in a bad way that basically can bring harm very quickly to people. Mm-hmm. At first, it was celebrities, of course, because mm-hmm. they were the one popularly replacing the faces on the porn actresses. But then it's or very quickly you can bring it logically to politicians being very very right. scared. Than the normal people as well, because if it's easy to do, that means it can be mass produced, and therefore, yeah, that's why the interest so quickly sparked. This is what the reason, I would say, socially. Mm-hmm. Technology-wise, it's just a natural progression, I would say, technology. Great breakthrough there, I would say. Socially wise, yeah, the impact was because it came from there, from that type of dark corner of internet.
I am just curious because you said that rightfully so. I mean, as long as internet exists, there have been some sort of manipulation of sort. More often than not, it's with celebrities of any kinds, because we are obsessed, I guess, as a society with people who are higher up the so-called ladder. But I'm curious, if you are, let's say, non-technical or outside the field, how would you even start creating a deepfake?
Okay, all right. So if we go back to a deepfake, so basically we could consider there are two types of deepfake. There is the image that is entirely synthesized. So you could synthesize, and generally they are portraits kind of image. It can be of a very high resolution images, portrait of a face of a person, not a large scene, including a person, really, I'm talking about the portrait. Mm-hmm. So these images can be completely synthesized, and the type of arm of, let's say, target or use of those images is mostly, let's say, to do misinformation or to create fake profiles. So the internet and social networks, you can create a fake profile on any social media with a fake image of someone that doesn't exist. You just generate a picture of a nice lady, of a nice man, you were good looking. And like this, you can contact people and you can, so it's not really impersonation, right? So here you are going to, and you could try to use this fake profile for instance, for espionage. Mm-hmm. So there have been cases that have been reported of espionage with fake profiles. And then the second type is mostly what we call face swaps.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So face swaps. So and this was one of the first case that was reported in those years of 2017. Basically, non-consensual pornography. What Pavel has said. But now, which is used also for manipulating media. So basically, to do disinformation. We're seeing recent cases with the Ukrainian president. I think there was a fake video that very recently that was done. So basically, the goal of a face swap is to make someone say something they never said, for instance, or to display this picture, this media material together with text, which is the content disinformation, right? But very often, and then using content which is altered. Then coming back to the face swap, the technology which is behind require still to have access to two kind of elements. First, you need to have access to the software that allows to make that face swap. This software is widely accessible now. I mean, you can find on many platforms, open source platforms such as GitHub kind of software. You can start to have also these kind of apps for free that appears on the internet,
right?
That you can buy. And therefore, you can also find these kind of services on the dark web. Since the code is open source, you can have some people that can make profit out of it and make illegal services, I would say. Now, to do this deep fake, still, you need to have access material, I mean, images of the persons you want to attack. So let's say that you have your victim, so you want to target someone. So for instance, to create a fake media involving that person that person has done or has not done anything, all right? You want to impose that the face of that person on a video, let's say. So typically what you need to have is access to couple of images or couple of many images of that of your victim. Okay, because you actually what you need to do is need to have to train a deep architecture to convert the face of someone into the face of someone else. So generally, I take also the example of the Tom Cruise example. We've seen these videos of Tom Cruise recently on social medias. The way this is done is not completely automatic. There is a lot of, it's semi-automatic. There are a lot of, main labor behind. So you need first to, you need to have an actor, okay, a kind of a sibling, let's say, that is going to dress, act, speak in the same way that the victim, okay? And you are going to record that footage in high quality. And then you are going to post-process this video, do face detection, face alignment, and you are going to take all the images, face images of that person, which is a source from the source media. Okay, you have face crops, and then you have all the face images of the victim. In this particular case, this would be Tom Cruise, right? And that's, it's very easy to find plenty of images from Tom Cruise on the internet, from movies. So you can generate a very large data set of images of your source and of your victim. And then you train an autoencoder basically to take an image as input from the source and to reconstruct as any image from the victim. When your network has learned to do that, then you take again your source video, you do face detection, face tracking, and you take the feed and you process frame by frame. You take the image in an image, the face in an image. You send it to the autoencoder that is going to transform it into the face image of Tom Cruise, having the same mimic facial expression that was in the source image. And then you replace that output into the original source. And this is where the complicated part can come, because you always have artifacts that are in because of the blending process. And this is why very often you need to have a human intervention, which is going to, let's say, reduce the artifact by hand, looking at the different places in the image, in the border, where you want to remove artifacts, for instance. So there is another post-processing, which is manual there. And this is how you can get a very good looking deepfake with involving a face swap. See that it requires a lot of time from someone which have basic, I would say, computer science skills, right? But I would say still minimal. And with time and with time and motivation, a lot of people can do it.
And GPU,
GPU now, you need to have GPU, because the software, generally, the deep learning architectures require GPU, so graphical processing units, which are nowadays available on almost any good laptops.
Yeah.
Right. So you can.
But it's money. It's money, basically. So still, it's money and time. It takes some time. Yeah.
I mean, it's also, I guess, a matter of time. Like, the GPUs will start getting rather cheaper as well, the more we move forward. So maybe then it's even more accessible. I think it's interesting, because you guys already were talking about the use cases, and rather, the way you described this was more in the negative light. I mean, that's how I also see deepfakes, is like you said, like, you need a victim, for example, in this example of Tom Cruise, which is true. But I mean, there are also, I don't know if it's a positive use case, but there is a big marketing use case, which is happening now, like in LinkedIn, for example. What they are doing is, there are a lot of companies which are generating fake profiles for employees. And these people do not exist on internet. So it's not like they're copying someone's images or something, because they don't have too many employees, but they want to appear that actually they have 50 employees so that they can hire good people and things like that. So they're also using deepfake technology to generate these profiles. And there actually are some court cases about it as well. So I was wondering, what are actually the use cases of deepfakes, besides the entertainment aspect of it, or the one use case which I just mentioned? What are the use cases of it, be it good or bad?
Right, so that's a good question. Actually, we are exploring one good side of the coin, right? Of the technology which is behind, is what else you can do from those technologies by synthesizing images, in particular. So in our research, so in our group here, we are working on biometrics recognition. So let's say face recognition, recognizing people. And we have a lot of concerns of all the security aspects and the privacy aspects. So one of the issues we have nowadays is that the state-of-the-art technologies to do face recognition are also based on deep learning architectures. So deep neural networks that take an image in and that basically transform the image into a representation which is compact and efficient to recognize the identity which is in the image. Now, the catch is that in order to train those deep architectures, you need to have huge data sets of faces, of identities. So to give you an idea, you need to have several millions of images, several hundred thousands of identities with several hundreds of images per identities. It gives you a bit of sense of the scale that is required. And then the first question that can come to your mind is, where this data comes from. Okay, so when we do research, we collect this data from the internet, or people that can do it, and we share this data for research only, not for commercial purposes. But in many cases, when we collect data, we obtain the explicit consent from the data subjects in those images. But in many places in the world, in order to train data sets face recognition models on images of that size, there is no way you can get consent from 100,000 people. So actually, there is no consent obtained from those people. So people are actually, so researchers are using data sets that are public data sets because they are public figures. Mostly you find public figures inside those data sets, called from the web, celebrities, politicians, you name it. And those data sets are bundled and shared for research only. Now, in reality, it's very, very likely that companies that also develop face recognition technologies, which are based also on deep learning technologies, they also have data sets of that size. The question is, where those data sets come from? And here we have no answer. We don't know. We can just speculate about it. And then the comes the problem. The problem is, how do you do in a society, especially in Europe, which is enforcing more and more data protection, which very soon is going to enforce this Artificial Intelligence Act, which is going to prohibit online face recognition in public spaces. In this kind of scenarios, you need to really understand where is your data and where your data comes from. If you obtain consent from people, if you have the right to do what you are doing, And then we came with the idea possibly to use deepfakes, I mean, deepfake technologies, so that are used to generate synthetic images like GANs and autoencoders. If we could synthesize images of persons that don't exist, so that those we could form data sets of images that don't of persons that don't exist, that could replace existing data sets of real persons, basically. So the idea is, could we generate synthetic data sets, but which are so realistic that can serve as a proxy to, or they can replace data sets used for benchmarking or data sets used for training completely or partially. So we can basically substitute synthetic data sets, real data sets by those synthetic data sets, basically. That will circumvent all those problems we are going to soon face with all these data protection aspects, which are going to be more and more important in the near future.
Interesting. Pavel, do you have anything to add?
So this similar idea, but let's say data sets for, we have also like work on age detection of kids, especially for minors, like for protection of minors online against the harm that they can experience online. So we have developing tools for automatic detection of age detection of kids, so that kids cannot interact with software that is not allowed or watch website or advertisements like this. So, but there is no data sets of kids. This is actually very, very hard to get, because if we are talking about consent from adults, I mean, kids is even worse, right? It's like, it's almost like medical data. It's very hard to get. So there's very few images or audio samples of kids. So one way to mitigate this problem is to basically generate synthetically data sets of kids, like random kids, small kids looking, you know, images, synthetic, unreal, kids that don't exist, and then train this type of tools, networks also to detect age of kids so they can learn that. So this is another direction. But then there are some public examples that I found, let's say, in America, there is like a Dalí University, Salvador Dalí University, not university, the museum. And they created like interactive screens, interactive, like if you go to a museum, there is like a deep fake of Dalí, basically. They created Dalí who's interacting with visitors to the museum. So you press a button and a Dalí figure in the screen will pop up and describe you. So there's an actor behind it with a voice that kind of mimics Dalí in English. With this kind of accent, and then they generated the deepfake basically of face of that to convert that actor into the Dalí, because they have a lot of images of Dalí, and then there is a kind of this kind of museum interactive scenario, which is nice. It's a positive example. There is also like an advertisement by Tom Cruise, it's Beckham, the football star. Mm-hmm. There is advertisement from like against malaria. He has this like social ad where he speaks different language, And they generated a face to mimic the lip movements, basically, of that language, like Chinese language or Spanish language. That you know, it's like there's a kind of a more smooth interaction with that. I've also heard from the friends working in the big companies like Facebook and Microsoft that there are some deepfake technologies and synthetic technologies used to mitigate the problem with connections with like tools like Zoom or Skype or tools like that to keep the, if there's a bad connection, to keep some kind of face movements.
Okay.
Interesting. Using kind of synthetic generations. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's not, I haven't seen it. Like with my own eye yet, but there's work going on that. So when so there's no freezing, so it doesn't freeze at least, but right. You keep the audio
video compression.
So it's a video compression type of thing that you can kind of synthetically add the texture and mouse movement on the fly that even if you don't have the connection to actually have a real video there, right? So that there is this kind of capabilities mm-hmm. that I looked into. There are things like that. You can mm-hmm. it's not always bad, of course. Yeah, right. So
NVIDIA did something on the similar lines, right? NVIDIA did something on the similar lines where if the camera angle is not right, they can recorrect your eye gaze towards the screen, because that was a published paper, if I remember correctly, in 2020 or 2021. So I'm not sure about Facebook, but that thing has been done.
Yes.
I quickly want to clarify, or just for my purpose, we talk about one first approach that Sebastian mentioned, wherein we can create people who never existed. And there's a website as well called peoplewhodonotexist.com, mm-hmm. where you can go and see millions of people who have never existed on Earth, possibly. But even for that, it's not that we can start from a blank canvas, right? We still need some sort of real human faces to begin with. And then we treat them as what you call vectors. And we change certain features, like a vector in this case could be changing some nose features, changing some skin color a bit, eye colors, eye position. And then we create this person, right? Like we still cannot create actual human face out of nothing.
So yes and no. So mm-hmm. if we look at the traditional methods for image synthesis, which mm-hmm. is basically relying on 3D models and so biological models of, let's say, of the bone structure, of the muscles, skin, texture, and so on, we can generate faces that don't exist. Now they look very synthetic. The advantage of the deep learning based methods is that it's the images are much more realistic.
Okay.
Now the problem is to control them, to control basically all the variables that will allow to change facial expressions, you know, these kind of things. As you say, the drawback is that you need to have already an initial training set of images in order to create train the synthesizer, in which case we use data sets, okay, which for which the consent exists, or for which the license is very clear. There is a license that permits to generate this synthesizer, I would say, right? Which is very different from other scenarios where you use much larger data sets to create face recognition technologies. Those synthetic face generators, generally the identity information is not relevant. You don't know who are the persons on the data sets. You don't need to distinguish that person from another one. It's completely unsupervised. You learn what is a face.
Mm.
Okay, and then the model is going to learn all the variabilities that he saw during training time in the data set. But as you say, yes, you need to have an initial data set. Now there are research directions also which are trying to merge deep learning with data sets with traditional 3D based methods. Okay. There's also a strategy trying to put those two fields together and come with methods which are, let's say, more 3D aware. So 2D generation methods which are more 3D aware. And there is a lot of research on that. And there have been quite a number of publications and models published on that recently.
Okay. All right.
Sebastian said that, yeah, we have like a original data set. We train the synthesizer of the face. And then we don't really change. So when we generate a totally synthetic face, we cannot really know exactly how to change like a shape of a nose. It's very hard to, it's much harder to control it. Mm-hmm. But when we are like controlling a space that we don't actually know very well. So it's like a space as a, we have the kind of feature vector, like a large, relatively large feature vector with some kind of values in it that represents a face. And what we do, we change some of the values in this vector just randomly sometimes, or in certain with certain logic in it. But we change the values, and then from that vector we generate face back, some kind of face. And we don't really know very well yet what values will lead to what kind of changes. I mean, some of these values we know, but not all of it. So we cannot really like pinpoint. Let's modify a specifically nose of the. Of a person, we cannot really do that very well. There is a danger there. Yeah, there is a danger there that you know, can we ensure that the synthetic face we generate is definitely not anyone who was in a training set or anyone similar to that? This is very hard actually to know exactly. So there is this is like a research direction as well right now.
Because my initial reaction was that. Yeah, that it will be probably very similar to the things which are in the data set.
So that's a very good question. And of course, this is something we verified. So generally what we do is that so let's say we have a synthetizer, again, that was used to synthesize faces, which has been trained on a data set A, okay, on a given data set. Then we take the synthesizer, and as Pavel explained, the way the synthesizer works is that it is able, basically, it is initialized from a set of random numbers, real numbers. You know, let's say you have several hundreds of real values, floats, and from those numbers, it can generate an image. And the way it has been trained is completely unsupervised. Okay, so we don't know really the structure in this vector of numbers. So we don't. This is what Pavel was explaining. We don't know what controls what, really. We just know that if we put random numbers, we get a random image. So the first thing we do is that we generate plenty of random faces. And in order to verify that those faces are not from the original training set, we verify it with a face recognition technology. So we use automatic face recognition to compare if any of the synthetic faces we generated matches any of the data images in the data set. Mm-hmm. And then for the few that exceeds the matching threshold, we verify by hand, visually. And we find that it is due to an aberration of the image, for instance. So, and then what we have observed by experiment, that indeed the synthetic images we generate do not match any from the original. New faces.
Just quickly, out of curiosity, what is the success rate, would you say, if you have seen data for such experiments, or maybe you or your lab has done those already, like how much percentage are actually not matching the data set, you would say, right now?
Our percentage, so it's very, very low. I think it's a few tens of images, I mean, about 10 images that exceed the matching threshold over a data set of, I don't know, several thousands. 10,000s of images.
Pretty good.
It's very little. And when we look at those images by inspect, we realize that actually the synthesized image that were generated that match an image from training set is actually visually, it doesn't look like the same person. It's an aberration. It's an image which is distorted, which kind of matched by accident, more or less. So actually not a human anymore in the image. Mm. Because you can have also this kind of problems with deepfake technologies. It can sometimes generate an image which contains a lot of semantic errors. So for instance, if you look at the image, you realize there is something wrong, like there are three eyebrows, or there is maybe an eye which is not really like human looking.
Right.
You know, this kind of semantic errors.
Yeah, the typical ones are like absence of the eye frames, like you have the eyeglasses around, but they're hanging in the air, or the, you know, things like that. I mean, there are a lot of issues actually with deepfakes. Yes, as Sebastian points out, the semantics are not there, right? So this is just a kind of image matching, and ugly things can happen. Sometimes you can have very ugly images, scary ones, like horror movie type of images, melted faces and stuff. Happens.
So basically the way, this is the first thing we do, that we exclude, we verify that the synthetic images we have generated are not from the original data set that has trained the synthesizer. And then we try to make sense from the inputs, this input vector, to understand the structure inside it.
Right.
Since it was trained completely in a supervised way, this is what is referred generally to as latent space, we call it in our domain. And then we try to understand which dimension, I mean, which index of which value controls what, basically.
Yeah.
So it's never so clear that you can say, oh, that the second scalar, or the second real number controls the pose, let's say. No, it's more complicated than that.
Just to expand a combination. To expand here a bit, this is like, this might be a term that would be not so familiar for many. So when we talk about latent space, I'll just briefly summarize so that you can continue. What my understanding is, we see images as humans and pictures and in red, green, and blue and everything, but more often than not, the neural networks that we're talking, they would just end up making all these images into some numbers arranged in some matrix-like form, right? And so that is where inside we are talking, essentially for very trivialized version, for people who are listening, they could understand it's just some numbers that represent the entire face. And that's what deep learning research community calls that latent space. That's a hidden space that's usually not so obvious even to researcher. What does it mean? Please continue.
Yes, sure. I can compliment on that. This is a very fancy term for mathematical notion, actually. So So when you observe a phenomena, right, let's say you observe an image, you know that the what describes this image, what makes a face, is conditioned by a number of things, by a number of elements which are that you finite number of characteristics, right? You know that when you see a face, there is the pose, there is illumination, you know, you can number a lot of those things, okay?
Right.
But in practice, when we have a software or mathematical tool which is implemented that generates those images, you don't have this very explicit manner, okay? You have, for instance, this vector of numbers, and you know that those numbers, basically, they are they correspond to those finite characteristics, right? Those latents. So this, you can consider them as groups of attributes that characterize an object or a phenomena. And you don't know really what dimension, which real number of this feature vector correspond to which latent. So that's why we call it a latent space.
Mm-hmm.
And we know, we hypothesize that there are some groups of factors, those latents, right, in that space, and all the possible combinations of those numbers that the numbers can take. And we just try to make sense of what does what and which combination of the dimensions of real values impact on what. And this is things that we try to dig into a posteriori after the model is trained. Of course, there are other strategies, there are other technologies such as variational autoencoders, where we try to enforce that structure of training time. So it's no longer completely unsupervised. We try to force some part of this large feature vector, let's say, to encode identity or to encode pose or to encode these kind of things. Okay, we try to enforce this into the latent space. But this is also not so simple.
I mean, just to take a step back from the technical understanding of things, I was curious, the use case which you described has a significance for people in the field, especially deep learning research community, I think. Of course, I already hear one good example from Pavel, which he mentioned about identifying for kids if they're underage or not. So there can be long tail effects of what you are trying to do or possibility of using synthetic data. But what are some use cases which you think like are directly useful from deepfakes, if there are any, for people who are not necessarily from the field? But does not even have to be non-technical, just outside the research community, like this deep learning bubble, what would be the use cases comes to your mind?
Well, extortion is the way that the bad one that we clearly can see right away, right? So like ask people for money pretending to be somebody else.
Yeah.
But also this museum that I mentioned, this is a good one that you can have interactive interactive displays with dead people art. Yeah, basically.
Entertainment art.
I just realized something which you mentioned. I think dubbing can also be changed in future with that, because as you said, with example of Beckham, so maybe especially in countries like Germany or maybe also in France, I'm not sure, where dubbing is a very, very big thing for movies and things like that or shows. So I guess it could be very interesting use case there. I'm not sure if there is already something happening there.
People are working on it for sure. Yeah. Like dubbing with the movement of the mouse, especially, right? Because the dubbing now is just a voice, right? And the person moves lips in the original language. So they're looking at how to seamlessly dub in such a way that it repeats the movement for the language it's dubbed on. So that will be much more immersive experience. But it's it's not easy, as you can imagine, because if you've seen the Star Wars type of synthetic generators that they're trying to use for this dead actress who plays Leia, right? What's her name? Forrest. I forgot the name of the woman who died, and then they put her in into the Star Wars movie. You can see it's not real actually in the cinema, especially like with the high resolution with the good lighting of the cinema. You can see this is fake, and this is like people who have all the resources in the world to generate synthetic 3 seconds video, which they do by hand, retouch like 500 times, right? And still you can see. So that means, you know, we're not really there yet in terms of automated, seamless dubbing or synthetic generation that's very, 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 very good quality that we're kind of scared of. That's actually another kind of topic that I'm touching on, but yes.
You touch upon a very interesting point, both of you, in the last couple of minutes of conversation, which is Sebastian mentioned it as identifying semantic features of a face is a very difficult task for any computer program to do. But for humans, it's somewhat more easier. Your lab is in a very special position because I do not know many labs that study the detection of a deepfake video versus the original video and compare the performance of humans who are able to detect it, that whether it was deepfake or not, versus a deep neural network that you trained that was able to detect whether it was deepfake or not. Could you shed some light on how accurate humans are and what's the state of the art for neural networks so far? In deepfake,
Pavel, this is for you.
I can say that. Yeah, so the main findings with the study that we did was compare the human subjects that we basically made them watch fake and non-fake videos, trying to figure out if it's fake or not, with different varieties of deepfakes, so different quality of deepfakes, which is basically we manually selected from the large data set. And to represent type of difficulty that humans would encounter when they look at the deepfake. So like semantic stuff, like I was mentioning, the iframes are missing, or the when the person is talking, the mouse is moving such a weird way that you can see something is definitely off, or some, you know, melting faces. Like this is a typical, like the face is kind of half of surface melt, right? So it's like a horror movie type of stuff. So you can even obviously see it's fake very quickly as a human. So like mismatching stuff, when typical artifact in the video, especially when the person is moving about, you have a blurring kind of shaking stuff on the borders of the face, kind of strange flickering everywhere. I mean, it's very obvious in the video. So so this type of different type of difficulty in terms of seeing this type of artifacts. And then, so human subjects pay attention to this type of things, like that's what I'm describing. This we all kind of can figure out and understand. If you see a mismatch in certain thing, we can clearly see something. But there are some cases of deepfakes when this is not obvious. Let's especially in the situations like lighting conditions that are not very, like shot in the dark. Like it's a dark environment already. Everything is kind of gray. everything is a bit grainy and bad lighting and things like that. So you don't see a lot of blurring. It's already badly compressed video, things like that. So it's like in the bad conditions, people cannot see it's fake. It's a it's kind of, so that's what also, if you look at the scandals, which we see sometimes online of like, you know, the Pelosi was being accused, she was drunk in an American public discourse. There was no deepfake there, actually. That was a simple technology. They slowed down the video, right? Mm. But the quality of the video was so badly compressed and everything was looking so bad on purpose. That when you click on the, when you look at it on the phone, you don't actually, you know, see even real things. You only see that, oh, it looks like Pelosi. Yeah. And everything else is degraded on purpose. So you hide the artifact, you hide that manipulation you did into the real, you muddy the water on purpose so you don't see the artifact that is, would be obvious otherwise. Yes, that's what happens with deepfakes that are kind of trying to do like a disinformation propaganda. They degrade everything that you don't see what is wrong and what is not, right? So in this situation, yeah, humans are not very good at distinguishing fakes from not. But the algorithms, what is interesting is they are very different. They are not humans, right? This is what we should never, when people say, oh, machines replace us, they are not the same. They are totally, they're alien. It's like an alien type of entity. They are looking at, so when they're looking at these videos, deepfake videos that to us look very obvious, because we look at semantics, at connections that we are trained to do, our human vision system is trained to do, they don't see that. They're looking on something completely else, like some kind of a residual noise or whatever else. They're trained in a certain way. We don't actually even know exactly what they look at. But for many algorithms that that are looking at this video, they are, let's say, good at identifying videos that are hard for humans to see, but very bad sometimes, right? Sometimes they can be very bad at identifying the videos that are obvious to us. So they are kind of like, there is no correlation with human vision and computer vision. This is like they are orthogonal. So they almost orthogonal. They are looking at these deepfakes totally different ways. There is no connection with what we think identify like a wrong, strange looking video and what algorithm perceives. So this is something we should not forget. Like that's what we were saying, that we should not relate humans and algorithms together. They're kind of similar entities. They're totally not. So yeah, I mean, algorithms are statistical machines, right? So they're trained in a certain way. Whatever you present to it as something, it will kind of make sense that this is the only, and what it learns, we don't sometimes know, right? What we train algorithm distinguishing fakes from not by presenting them images or videos with fakes and videos or images with not fakes and say, this is a stats, but that beyond that, they cannot see. They are not, this is not God. We should not forget that also.
I think the question which people say is like, I mean, especially people who are a little bit, at least from computer science, it's like, okay, ultimately, humans are feeding the data, right? Humans are writing the algorithms, which means they are also putting their biases. So hence everything can, like, of course, in a very ideal scenario, like, the algorithms are completely rational. There is no, because with our vision, we even have emotion attached to it. So for example, if I'm a Republican and if I'm looking at Pelosi's video, then I have a certain, you know, feeling towards it. If I'm a Democrat, I have a certain feeling towards it, which is not the case with algorithms, but I guess people always question, well, ultimately people are writing algorithms. So hence, I think sometimes people kind of mismatch that, okay, it is not necessarily going to be that always all the biasness comes into place. But anyways, that's a different discussion. What I'm more interested in, that this always, like, especially with deepfakes, I mean, also since you guys have been also very open about it, that we are doing all the good stuff with it. I think you even started with the example of distortion and things like that, right? So where do you stand, or what's your opinion on the ethical boundaries of the field itself, I would say? Like, I would like to know your personal opinion. Do you consider the technology itself ethical? And not talking about deep learning and things like that, not talking about the bigger picture, just talking about deep fakes per se. And then how do you feel about, just at a very personal level, working on it?
So So it's always a very difficult question. Generally, it's I never answer these kind of questions on the ethical aspects because ethics is something which is very personal, actually. Your ethic, your ethics, the two of you, myself and Pavel, are probably very, very different, and also the one from people which are going to listen to us. So, I mean, that is, it's not like you draw a line somewhere and you're wrong or you're bad. This line can be very different for each of us. Okay, this is something very subjective. Now, generally, I prefer, so first, there is a legal framework, and legal is something more tangible because it's something you have rules which are written, you have laws that you respect and don't respect. It's something which is not so bad that it is not ethical. Actually, it should not be, should be banished. It should be illegal. First point. This is my first element. And this is where the researchers, they have a role to play. Okay. They have to investigate technologies and look at the positive and negative sides, publish in order to provide the information to the public authorities to whether decide if something should be, citizens should be protected. Now, in order to do so, it's important that the research have the academic freedom to investigate a number of problems. And what I think is even more important is that researchers should be transparent. Okay, it's transparency, I think is key to security and to protection in the long future. Because if we just hide things, nothing will happen. So this is something that we have been looking for many, many years, is that putting a lot of transparency on our research. So that means that we publish, and that when we publish, we allow other researchers to reproduce our findings. Okay? So ourselves, we don't develop deepfake technologies, right? So we do use deepfake technologies that have been developed by others, but anyway, those deepfake technologies are not deepfake technologies. They are just deep learning technologies applied to specific data in a specific way, right? So it's not like we're developing software, an application that we put on App Store somewhere that you can click, download, pay, and we make money out of it. No way. First, because we do research and we don't develop products, we don't sell products. But what is important is, in order to understand the threat of a technology, you need to be able to assess it. So which means that you need to understand how it works. Because otherwise there is be a lot of myth and misunderstanding about the technology. So you need to understand how the technology works, to understand really the limits, whether it is a threat objectively. Okay. And to do that, there is no other way to look at it and to test that technology, try to use deepfakes, create deepfake images, and to see how well these deepfakes can impersonate someone with respect. I mean, for instance, if those automatic face recognition could be confused by a deepfake, a human, can it be confused to a deepfake, and what kind of deepfakes? And these are questions, research questions that we pose and we are trying to answer. Okay. And then if the answer are positive, that we can identify there is a threat somewhere and that can be assessed in an objective way, then it will be published, and therefore public authorities and decisors, they can take actions and say, yes, this is too dangerous because those people have demonstrated it is. You see the
yeah.
This is really a scientific methodology we have behind. And we are not experts in ethics or ethical aspects, I mean, or philosophy, or so there are other people which are for which this is their job, right? So, and also there are people we generally work together, we work with. So we share our findings, our objective findings, and like this also can relate on that. Today to help to inform even further citizens and decision makers about what is a threat and what is not a threat.
Yeah, small things that to Sebastian also, but from personal perspective, if you want some personal from me, for example, I look at it that we do not, as Sebastian said, we do not provide any tools to help develop this technology, right? Which I deem as more threatening than helpful, personally. And we, for example, used software that is open source to generate deepfakes, databases of deepfakes, so people can actually assess how dangerous or bad deepfakes are. So we publish these data sets, the videos themselves, but we don't, like we developed the software more to, let's say, mass produce a lot of videos, but we did not release it online, for example. We don't open source the things that to help in any way to make it easier for people. But we focus more on the technologies of detecting those deepfakes and fighting this type of deepfakes, so the people can be aware what is fake, what is not. This is more the focus of from the personal perspective. I deem myself as more like helping society fight this threat rather than create the threat. So therefore, my conscience is clean in that sense, at least.
Okay. Fair enough. No, but ethics is always a tricky question. Thanks for answering it in such an articulate manner. We had an elaborate discussion on it with Professor Christoph Lütke, who happens to be the director of TOM Institute of Ethics for Artificial Intelligence. And it's always, and we understand that it's very difficult to answer. Like it's like asking the same thing, was development of knife an ethical thing? A surgeon would say yes, but a murderer would also say yes.
Yeah.
But the point is, we discussed in length so far about the effects, the processing, and how deepfakes have been prevalent so far, even in the research communities, gaining a lot of momentum these days. This is on more of both of you guys. In near future, what are the technology in this space that excites you and that probably you are working towards that, and the ideas that excite you from other research groups as well?
I think it's also my moral obligation to add, because we have already discussed before this recording that you are not necessarily interested in talking about how, for example, social media companies can fight like deepfakes, right? Because that's not your research interest. But I think I'm actually genuinely curious, because I mean, ultimately listeners are not, they're also interested in the real use case which affect day to day. And I'm also curious, is there also like something happening in future where, you know, I don't know, we see a pop-up in an ideal world, oh, it's a deepfake video. Like now you have more and more in Facebook where they potentially flag quote unquote fake news, or on Twitter, it's the same.
So there are two sides, two aspects. So first, as you say, we are doing research. We are not developing products. So which means that we try to be disconnected, or let's say independent from any potential applications, okay? Because we don't want this to influence our thinking and our research. But at the same time, we are nurtured. I mean, we are looking at the world, right? We are looking at the reason why we are working a specific problem is that we have observed that this is a problem, or we think this is a problem because there are evidence about that in society. And clearly, we see where there could be applications. But since we are not businessmen, we cannot claim that the business is there, right? So, of course, we observe that deepfakes is a problem in many domains for which there is a business more than another one. I mean, criminal investigations, the application there of those technologies, I mean, or the detection technologies mostly, disinformation, so mostly social media and so on and so forth. So, but we try to, as I said, we try to be agnostic. So we look at what is the problem. From a scientific perspective, what we have is we have a detection problem. So we have a deepfake, so we have a material. The question is whether this material is manipulated or not. Okay, that's the first question. It can be for any reason. It can be for any sort of application. It can be for good or for bad. Maybe it was manipulation for good. Maybe it was manipulated for bad. Okay, maybe it was someone that go to court and say, okay, no, it's not me inside that media. It has been manipulated. But the answer is still in the end, whether something has been manipulated or not.
Yeah, understood.
So we look into this problem and developing technologies to answer those questions. Then it can be subsequent questions we might be interested in the future, because as we're scientists, we need to keep ahead, right? So we want to know, for instance, if there would be new form of attacks that could pop up in the future that we have to anticipate,
okay, in order to develop new technologies that could detect those new attacks, better attacks, even more realistic, maybe audiovisual, ultra-realistic attacks,
right,
forging the video plus the audio at the same time, in real time maybe.
Mm-hmm.
So this is something we are thinking of in the future as new form of attacks and threats we want to be able to detect.
Yeah.
And then there is more than the detection itself. There is also what we refer to as attribution. So if we know that there is a manipulation, the question is, can we identify what kind of manipulation was done? Maybe it's a deepfake, maybe it's a specific algorithm of a deepfake by some, and therefore you by like this, you can backtrack to the origin and the source of the attack. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So these are also a number of reflections and directions mm-hmm. where we are going.
Yeah. Pavel, you want to add something to this?
Yeah, I agree. Well, this is basically, yeah. So intersection is attribution is the something that we are working on a lot. And for the attacks, the in terms of technology that is where it's going is multimodal, yeah, audiovisual manipulation that together match. Because so far, there's like very few data sets exist that you have both fakes of audio and fakes of video. Fakes of audio is actually not that easy to produce, especially if you want to match an identity of some person. They're mm-hmm. not yet solved. This problem is not yet solved in audio domain. But together, matching the lips, moving with the audio, that everything is fake, audio is fake,
mm-hmm.
belongs to that person you're trying to mimic, like Tom Cruise, the mannerism, the accent, the way that Tom Cruise talks, plus his mimics and his expression, matching lips with the audio, with the speech that he's saying, all that is not yet done, and it's very hard to do at this point, but this is the direction where these fakes are coming to. Hyper realistic, as Sebastian mentioned, the video generation is, with audiovisual generation is not easy, and it's, I actually don't even know personally, I'm not sure it will happen, like they're actually all fully automated. I doubt it's possible with the technology we have.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But
well, maybe it does, and that's new. Not you talking at the moment. Maybe you're completely fake
yeah.
right
yeah.
now. For an hour, you're talking to a bot.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's right. Maybe you are talking to two bots this whole time.
Maybe.
Very meta. That's oh, yeah, very, very meta, yeah.
All right. So on that note, I would say that thank you for answering some very difficult questions towards the end, and also explaining us what the wider landscape of deepfakes is. We definitely enjoyed the conversation a lot. Hope you did too, and hope people who are listening got to learn a couple of things here and there, of course. And with that, thank you for taking out time once again, and I hope you enjoyed the conversation.
Yes, it was great. Thank you.